All right, Matchroom Radio with David Diamante. We are back, and this week we are in Nottingham, England, and we have a great guest. We have a great show this weekend here in Nottingham. Before we start real quick, I just want to say thank you for all the love and support. I've been out for a couple of months, had a tough accident, got through it, getting through it, and happy to be back. So it's wonderful to be here. And like I said, we have a big show, the WBA Featherweight Championship of the World. We've got Lethal Lee Wood against Irish Michael Conlan. And the gentleman today that we have as our guest, Mr. Russ Anbar. First of all, hi, Russ. Nice to see you.
Listen, it's great to have you back, Dave. And I wish that the people would have had a chance to see the pictures that you were showing us in the elevator, because that really puts into perspective your comeback and that you're here today doing this, you know, because that was, I mean, some of the pictures you showed, Conlan went, turned his head, you know, it was quite scary what you were through. So it's good to have you back, brother.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. And I just want people to know that I have not posted those pictures online because I just thought I wanted to stay positive.
No, that's fine.
I didn't want to be gruesome, but the accident happened and I am back quickly. I am a resilient guy. I believe in the power of the mind. I really do. And I talked to the BBC earlier today and I was telling them some stories about as a kid. I shattered my kneecap in 8 pieces and my mom wouldn't take me to the hospital. 3 days later, it's not broken. I said, Mom, it's broken. I mean, it looked like a melon. It was disgusting. The moment we go to the doctor, he's like, let me see the leg. You go, oh, that's broken. My mom goes, I knew it. But I came up with this mentality, you know. And, you know, my dad, we'd be on a hot day in a car with my brother and my sister. And it's, you know, the summers in New York are brutal. So we'd be back there and we're like, Dad, we're thirsty. He'd be, drink your spit. You know, that's what my dad would say. So this was kind of the upbringing I had. And this is the mentality I have to get back. I can't stay hurt. There's no feeling sorry for yourself. And, you know, you mess with the bull, you get the horns. I was on a motorcycle. I've ridden them around the world. I've had accidents before. I've broken a lot of bones before. So I knew what it was. This one was terrible. You know, four breaks to the spine, multiple broken ribs. And my knee was really, really in bad shape.
Yeah, I saw that too. That was graphic. Yeah,
so it was tough. But and I'm still in pain, but I'm getting through it. And I'm really happy to be here. And I'm really happy to see you. For the fans out there today that don't know you, Russ, you wear a lot of hats in this business. And you've been in this business for a lot of years. You were an amateur boxer. Yeah. Very short career.
Short, yeah.
You were a trainer.
Yep.
You owned a boxing gym, which you've since gotten rid of, but you own a boxing gym.
Well, we still have the gym still exists. It's one of my former fighters who's running it now. Yeah, right. That still exists.
You are known as one of the top hand wrap specialists in the world.
Thank you.
You are an ace cut man.
Thank you.
You are also, am I right, the founder of Rival Boxing Gear?
That is correct.
That's pretty much
we summed it all up. Thank you for joining us, folks.
Right.
Astronaut.
So you wear a lot of hats in the boxing world, and let's go back just a little bit. So you're Canadian.
Correct.
We're not going to hold that against you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Montreal, yeah?
Yeah, born and bred.
The 76 Olympics, can you take me back to that? Is this where it really all began for you? You got bit by the bug?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. You know, it was at a time, you know, the Olympics were coming to Montreal, and ABC covered the Olympics in a fashion that I don't think we see today. And, you know, we're able to watch all the fights on TV and watch that evolution of that. To me, still the greatest U.S. Olympic team ever.
Hold on. Okay, so wait. Let's just pause right there for a second. So 76?
84.
Or 84?
Yeah, listen. I mean, 76, both good. You know,
Howard Davis, yeah, Sugar Ray Leonard.
The Spinks brothers, you know, the Leo Randolph. There was some iron on that
And then
team.
The 84.
Correct.
You know, Sweet Pea. You know, Holyfield, yeah, Breland,
100%,
Taylor, Meldrick Taylor. Yeah.
There was some great match.
Yeah, but I love that debate. Right,
I'll tell you what, a dream debate would be me, you, Buddy McGirt, John Scully, and we put the teams together.
My God.
We put it together and we matched them up.
The Ice
and
Man.
I think the 70. We've kind of felt, maybe the 76 team might come out ahead by one fight.
Right,
you know,
right,
some
right.
fights could go either way. You know, so listen. But for me in 76, 84 didn't exist yet, did it?
Sure.
So, you know, as a 15-year-old kid watching the stories being told to us by Howard Cosell, you know, learning about Howard Davis, who really was my inspiration of that team. Because
rest in peace.
And his mom had died 2 weeks before the games, and he still went. And Leonard fighting with, you know, the tape picture of his girlfriend on the sock. You know, he had his tape, right, had her picture taped to his sock. And the way Cosell presented it, you know, like, I think the world somehow misses and doesn't understand what the way boxing was presented in those days. And it made you feel like these guys were household names, Dave. You know, they became household names. And that was the first thing that got me all excited. And that summer, I hung a heavy bag in our garage, and I built a speed bike platform using the steel from old lawn chairs. You know, I put wood and I screwed it all together, and I built a speed bike platform, built my own little gym. And then when Rocky came out in November of that year, that kind of sealed the fate. And that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And as a little kid growing up outside of Montreal, you know, in a little town of 5,000 people, you know, to be able to have dreamed this at that time and then make it a reality in my life, like, I still sometimes am amazed that that happened, you know, that I thought about wanting to be in boxing in some way. And I used to watch the fights and the fighters and the trainers. I used to tell people, you know, fighters watched, and they had different people that were heroes. My heroes had a towel over their shoulder and a cotton swab in their mouth. You know, those were the guys I watched, you know, and I watched the corner and I watched how they worked. And I'm living what I thought and dreamt about as a 15-year-old kid. So, it's nice.
So,
kind of cool.
76, they have the Olympics. You get bit.
Mm-hmm.
Rocky comes out. Now it's deep in your blood.
Correct.
Yeah, you're sick for life.
Yeah, yeah.
3 years later, you're working with Vinnie Curto.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. How did that hookup happen?
That's still, to me, you know, a great moment in my life, because lots happened with Vinnie. Vinnie was in Montreal. He was world-ranked middleweight. He's in Montreal, and I'm training as an amateur fighter at the famed Olympic Boxing Club. The Olympic Boxing Club back in those days in Montreal was what was the equivalent to what the Kronk was in the States, you know, or the Fifth Street Gym, like that more the Fifth Street Gym, I'd say that was the place. All the pros trained there.
Speaking of, I'm sorry, because you're talking about trainers, the guys that you love were the guys with, yeah, the talent, and you just talked about the Fifth Street Gym, and it just made me think about Angelo Dundee.
Yeah.
And I know that you're the guys that you really idolize. I mean, I don't know about idolize, but that you really look up to in that world. I mean, we're talking Futch, we're talking Dundee. You know, Arcel.
Yeah, Ray Arcel, Freddie Brown.
You know, guys like that.
I think that as a result of Vinny, while I was training in the gym and I met him and I said, I seen this guy's picture in boxing magazines. And so after a couple of days, I drummed up the courage to say, are you Vinnie Curto? And he says, yeah. I said, oh, I seen your picture in boxing magazines. I read about you. You know, I know you fought Rodrigo Valdez. And he was really impressed that a young kid like me knew about it. And I said, do you do road work? And he said, yeah. I said, do you mind if I go running with you in the morning?
And you're 18 at this time.
I'm 18. And he said, yeah, sure. So the daily running became running, then breakfast. And then it became running, breakfast, and then hanging out all day. And then it became running, breakfast, hanging out all day, and then going to the gym with him at night. And now all of a sudden I'm seeing myself transform from training as a boxer to being a boxing trainer. And I'm working with him, and I'm pointing out things, and we're talking boxing, and we're discussing stuff, and he's telling me about Angelo, who was his first trainer, and who he introduced me to later, and Angelo became a friend of mine later in life, you know, and I'll tell you the story about Angelo later, but, you know, it was special that he introduced me to that, and when a guy like Vinnie Curto gives you the belief that there's something there, you know, and he would brag about me and openly in front of people. This guy knows more about boxing than any of you in here. You know, he knows what. And I'm, oh, wow, I'm feeling good. At 18, when a guy like Vinnie Curto tells you that, it's something special. So that's how I started working with him. My first pro corner I ever worked was October 2nd, 1979. Vinny against Marciano Bernardi from New Jersey. Vinny won an 8-round decision. The next fight was the main event at the Montreal Forum, November 6, 1979. Vinny beat Eddie Mello on a 10-round decision. And when they announced the decision and Vinny won, his handlers picked him up and carried him, and he reached down and grabbed me and hugged me and wouldn't let me go, you know, while he was on their shoulders, you know. So that was kind of special.
How did it feel?
Yeah, it was it's the bug you always keep trying to get again and again. It's what you chase, you know. It's that's chasing the dragon, you know. That's That was special, and that it was done when I was so young. And that's why, you know, out of all the trainers that are around and have evolved today, Buddy might be a close second, but outside of Buddy, I don't know many guys, and I'm lucky because I started so young that I'm almost that last link between the Angelo Dundees and Eddie Futches and Gil Clancy's of the world, because I started so young, I was on the tail end of their great careers, you know, so I got to meet all of them, talk to all of them, learn from them. John Davenport was another guy who was so instrumental in my upbringing, and I got to meet these guys because I started so young, and a lot of the other trainers that are around now, you know, might be my age, but didn't start as young as I did, so they didn't get that connection with the past. So I see the difference between what trainers were like now, then, and what they are like now, and I try to keep that, some of those old traditions alive, including wearing a tie when I work the corner. So that's the respect.
It's funny, I was
going to
ask you about your attire, because tie. You're always wearing a shirt and tie, which I appreciate, but I'm wondering, is that, it's part of the old school, part of the work ethic?
Yeah, like, you know, I saw pictures of Bundini Brown back in the day and some of those trainers wearing a tie in the corner, and I thought it was respectful to the craft, you know. And I thought that the boxers deserved that I should show a little respect to the sport, to the dangers it possesses, to the courage that it takes for the guys to do it. And so when I show up like, we're a real organization, and we're proud to be here, and I respect what I'm doing.
I mean, I don't know if people know who you've worked with in the past, but, I mean, we could just go through a massive list of people from Jean Pascal and Elider Alvarez, Oleksandr Usyk, Lomachenko, yeah. So many guys, Sergio Martinez, you know, Mick Conlon. Let's just talk about Mick Conlon just for a second in this fight this weekend. Your role is cut man, yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's training with Adam Booth.
Yep.
What are you taking from this weekend here in Nottingham? What are you taking from this fight? He's obviously fighting Lee Wood for the regular version of the WBA featherweight strap. Thoughts?
Look, I like what I've seen this weekend, because I've been with Mick since very early in his career, and The meeting happened a little bit by accident, Dave, truth be told. When Conlon came out of the Olympics, and with all the controversy, as you know, getting robbed of the decision against the Keaton, you know, giving the finger to the AIBA officials, that whole bit, I made a pair of boxing gloves and sent them to Mick. And he thanked me on Twitter, and he appreciated it and the whole bit, and that was really nice. Fast forward ahead a couple of years, he's in Vegas fighting, and he's there with Adam Booth and Jamie, his brother, and they're looking for a cut man. So they asked me if I could do that, and I did. And great fight. He won. He stopped the guy in the 7th round. Everything went well. And after the fight, right away, Jamie came and paid me. And he put the money in my hand. We shook hands, and I left the dressing room to go back to my other dressing room where all my stuff was, because I was working with another fighter on that night. And when I got to the dressing room, I looked at the cash that he had given me, and I said, well, this is too much. You know, he's given me too much. It was a relatively easy fight. I didn't have much to do. You know, it was great to meet them. So I went back to the dressing room, and I gave him back some of the money. You know, and I said, thanks, but it's okay. You gave me too much. That's really nice of you. And I don't know if it's because of that, but the connection with Adam and with, especially with Jamie, really stuck. And I think Mick liked what I did in the corner, and I've been with him ever since. The only fight I missed was a fight that happened here in 2020 during the pandemic, when they weren't allowing any outsiders to come in. That's the only fight I've missed since then. So it's special for me to be part of that. And I've seen the ups and downs of Mick and struggling with different weights, trying to make 122 and how his energy is and whatnot. And today when I saw him at the weigh-in and he was pumped and ready to go, I haven't seen that energy from him in a while. And I like where he is. He's in a good space. And listen, I know that Wood is going to be a tough fight. You know, he's a good fighter. He gained a lot of confidence in the Shu Khan fight. But Michael is cut from a different cloth, and he has an extensive amateur background. He has success at different levels. He's been in with the best in the world, and God, he believes in himself, and I believe in what he can do, and I think tomorrow night he shocks the world.
I cannot wait for this fight. It was one of the fights I was like, I have to come back. I mean, like, I'm not going to miss this fight, you know. Right. When this fight was announced, I was so excited for it. I really love it, you know, and I think the Irish contingency coming over here tomorrow, it's going to be electric, man. I mean, just even the weigh-in earlier today.
I know, it's crazy, the passion. We don't get to see a lot of that on the North American side, you know.
It's a little different.
It is a little different. Now, Montreal, we get that. Those are the kind of fights we get. Like they're arena fights for fight fans. You know, they're not for the corporate. They're for the fight fans. And so I grew up in that kind of mentality of home guy selling tickets. You know, the other guy coming in from out of town, bringing his team with him. I've seen that. So it's very similar. But this happens consistently and has happened consistently in the UK. And they're cut from a different cloth in the way they present the boxing here. And it's part of the sporting culture. It really is part of the sporting culture all across the country. And it's something that's missing in North America, because North American promoters seem to have stopped doing that. They got site fees from casinos and they got TV revenue from televisions. They forgot about promoting fights. They forgot about selling tickets. They forgot about making it part of the community and local sales, you know, and that's, you get a different vibe at fights in North America than you do when you come over here to the UK.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that just the fans over here are rabid and they really support their charges, their local charges. They come out and they're also knowledgeable, which I like.
They, 100%.
They do their research on the fighters and the stories, because at the end of the day, you know, it's really character development. You know, if there's just two guys you don't know fighting, okay, it's interesting. But I mean, for you and I, I'll watch any fight, so I like it. But right. But to know people's backgrounds and the trajectory of their lives, and you talk about, you know, Lee Wood, what he's been through. You look at Mick Conlon, what he's been through. These guys are carrying a lot on their shoulders. There's a lot more than the strap. Okay, there's a lot more than the strap. The trajectories of the rest of these gentlemen's lives lay in the balance of what happens tomorrow night at the Motorpoint Arena. It's going to be a very serious thing.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And you know, Mick's been dreaming of this since that bad decision at the Olympics. He wanted a world title and got the shot now. You know, so
and you know, whenever you're in the spotlight, you know this. You get a lot of people that love you, and you also get your haters. And I know Mick's heard both. So he wants to put that to sleep. You know, he wants to win that world title.
Of course he does. Of course,
you know,
he does.
And you know, talking about the Olympics, I mean, you've covered, what, six of them?
Six. Yeah, that's right.
That's another thing that you do that I don't know if people know. You're a great commentator.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. Thanks. I've been doing that since 1988. My last one was London. That was the last one I covered. Canadian box broadcasters started using the generic feed for Olympics after that, because we didn't have any performance on the Canadian squad. But I go back to when Canada was ranked 10th in the world and we had Lennox Lewis and Egerton Marcus and Raymond Downey winning medals. And, you know, we were on the podium back in those days. So I was fortunate enough to do that and did six Olympic Games. It was nice.
Speaking of Canadian boxing, I know you work a lot with Mark Ramsey.
Yeah.
Man, what's up with him and light heavyweights? It always seems to be light heavyweights.
Yeah,
what's up with him and 175 pounders?
I don't know why is that. And
Really like that, yeah, that division.
That weight class.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
But really seems to have brought a lot of shine. Former hockey player, right, Mark?
Yeah, Mark played hockey. We all did.
Well, you know, yeah, Canada, obviously.
He grew up playing hockey.
But he was pretty serious about it, I think, right? I think, didn't he go to the boxing gym just to kind of stay in shape, maybe in the off season, and he got bit by the bug?
I know he went in and started boxing as an amateur, so I don't know what his career was developing like as an amateur.
Yeah.
He was also into heavy metal music.
Right.
Was really into that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And then boxing got him, and we teamed up just before the Olympics in Greece. He started using my gym to train his fighters at, and when he made the decision to turn pro, he asked me if I would be the cut man for his team, and that was kind of when I made the decision that I was kind of getting out of my, you know, coaching career and going to the gym every day like I used to just having to go to camps and work with fighters specifically for fights. And that was more fun. I enjoyed that time, especially with Mark and Jean-Pascal getting ready for fights and going away to training camp. Roy Jones would be with us, and I enjoyed camp. I enjoyed doing those kind of things. And I did that with Wilder for 5 years as well.
Is it true that you've decided to kind of step away a little bit from the trainer circle because of family? You want to spend more time with family? And
yeah, it's just too time consuming, you know. It's just too time consuming to do it, you know, run the business. And also it's unfair to the fighters. If I would be doing that, it would be unfair to them because of the number of fighters I'm working with now.
Sure.
As a cut man and being on the road so much, so it wouldn't be really fair for me to do that. So I prefer that any of the fighters that I work with, if they want me to go into camp, I'm happy to go into camp with them, spend a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever it is, anywhere that's got a pool hall, I'm happy to go to and You can go to camp and just work with one specific fighter at a time for a specific match. I like doing that. It's where my time has come, you know, like, listen, I coached for over 30 years, you know, every day in the gym at 5:30 for 30 years. So, and I did what I set out to do from when I was a kid and what I believe that was instilled in my mind from Vinny and from working with John Davenport and watching Emmanuel Stewart when he was just an amateur, when he was training amateurs, was to take fighters and develop them from the amateur stage right to a world title. And in 1997, I got to do that.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, can we talk about Otis for a second, Otis Grant, and what was that like in Sheffield that night?
That was
against Rhodes.
It's still the highlight of my life.
Is that?
Yeah, it's still the highlight of my life because of the...
That because you had more hair and it was darker, or is it because
partly? But it was part of the thing that we dreamed about. You know, he was a kid.
Sure.
Comes into the kid. Comes into the gym. He's 13 years old.
Right.
He wants to learn. I said, oh, this kid got something special.
Sure.
You know? And you know, he does something. He looks a little, fights a little like Hagler, and oh, this is good. And I'm thinking, oh, we're gonna win a world title. And I'm dreaming. I'm a little kid, right? I'm still a kid, and I want to do this. And you know, that was 1981 when I started training him, and 1993, 94, he wins the a world title. And
in the Steel City special, in Sheffield.
You know, and that's something that I developed from the ground up, you know.
Absolutely.
And to prove it wasn't a fluke, I did it again with Lemieux, you know.
Right,
the ground up.
David Lemieux.
And there's not a lot of guys that can make that claim. You know, there's a lot of trainers who work with fighters that are already made or come out of an extensive amateur background or whatnot, but
correct.
You know, Mark did it with Jean Pascal and Antonin Dicarry, and you know, I did it with Otis and Lemieux and Howard Grant and so Hercules Kivelo, some fighters that you know went on to be world ranked after I had started them from when they were kids. But now I got to a point in my life where there's not enough years now to be developed, to have time to develop these guys. So I preferred the transitional role of going in as a cut man, and the guys who use me understand that I bring more to the corner than just a cut man. You know, that I am still a coach at heart. I'm still a trainer at heart. I see things in the corner that others don't see, and I can share that with the coach. And I can, when I scream an instruction, it comes from a good place.
There's so much that I want to ask about that. I mean, going back to that night, first of all, the Otis night, I mean, what a night. I think Dom Engel was in the corner of the other,
of
Rhodes.
So was his father.
Yep, Brendan.
His father.
Artie Palullo, was he?
Yeah, Art Palullo was the promoter.
He was the promoter.
Yeah,
him. Mike Goodall was the ring announcer.
Oh, was he? Okay.
And I love that man. Yeah. I think he was a great compere. And he's like the hardest working man in boxing.
Yeah, wow.
He's just wonderful, man.
I remember that night well.
Yeah. But both guys were southpaws.
Yeah, Rhodes would switch.
He would
back
switch,
and forth.
Right? But he could do he could fight southpaw.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a night.
It was great for me. One thing I took from that night was that at the press conference before the fight, I had told people about my love for Sheffield and how I dreamed of coming to Sheffield. But my dream to come to Sheffield was to watch the World Snooker Championships because that's where the World Snooker Championships are held every year. It wasn't for a fight. So it's ironic how Sheffield became synonymous for my love of snooker and having won my first world title in that city. So Sheffield holds a special place in my heart for me, and having won there in a place that's famous for snooker was nice.
Great city, great experiences. I have a question because I know that you keep alluding to snooker. I know you like billiards very much, but I also know you're into magic. That's a pastime of yours, a hobby.
Yeah.
Now, was Otis's name, because his nickname was Magic, was that because of you? Did you?
Good question. No.
Has anyone ever asked you that?
No, they haven't asked that. But
I was curious. I've always wanted to ask
that. His nickname was Magic.
Yeah, I always wanted to ask you that.
Believe it or not, it came from I named him that when we were with the other kids in the neighborhood playing basketball.
Okay,
so
like
it was Magic Johnson.
Johnson.
It was a name. It just kind of gave him the name off of Magic Johnson, and he played just like Magic, and he was powerful. And
it's funny, but it's kind of magical that he's your first world champ. And
what's ironic about the Magic, Dave, is that when I started getting into boxing when I was 15, I was working at a sporting goods store. I was a ski technician. I used to install bindings on skis and stuff like that, fix bikes in the summer, and had a guy working with us who was a friend of mine that we had played Little League ball together, and he was working there. He used to string tennis rackets. And he got into magic. And he started performing, and he would do tricks, and he would show us tricks that he'd do. And I was, oh, wow, that's really cool. And, you know, and I'm talking about boxing. My workshop is filled with posters of boxers.
Right.
Talking about boxing, and he's doing magic. So I learned some magic from him. We talk boxing, et cetera. Well, you know, I went on to have, thank God, quite a successful career in boxing. And he, at one point, was, I guess what you could say, the number fourth ranked magician in the world, and is still active today, and all the magicians know him. His name is Alain Chaquette. They all know him. Copperfield has gotten tricks from my friend Alain. And the irony of that is that we were two kids from a really small town, 5,000 people. We had a dream of wanting to do something, and we became among the best in our field from a dream that we had as kids. And that's kind of crazy, like when you look back on it. Now that I'm 16, I look back on it. I was a 15-year-old punk kid. You know, I wanted to be in boxing. This guy was doing card tricks. You know, I wanted to be a magician. And we became, you know, we went to the apex of our sports and our trades, which was kind of cool.
When you were boxing, I mean, you campaigned at 118, am I right?
Yeah. I didn't know all this stuff.
And then you had one fight at 126, which wasn't your weight. And it turned out bad for you.
Yeah, that was my loss, and that was.
And were you like, okay, that's not going to happen?
Yeah, and I had started smoking by then as well. You know, okay. It was not good. You know, it takes a certain something to be a fighter.
Sure.
But I knew though in my heart, I don't know how, but I knew no matter what the sport was going to be, I was going to be a coach. I was going to be a coach in something, whether it was going to be baseball, hockey, boxing. I was going to be a coach something. And to this day, I know that I can coach. Anything I learn about a little bit, I can coach it. I have that whatever ability is to break something down and teach somebody to do something and show them the pros and cons and the strengths and weaknesses and be able to get it done and teach them the proper technique and the form to do it. And my greatest accomplishment as a trainer hasn't been the great fighters that I worked with. It's been the mediocre fighters that have gone beyond where they should have gone because of their talent. And my greatest claim on that is a kid named Ron Donaldson, who came to my gym when he was 11 years old. He was so bad, we nicknamed him the duck. That's how good his footwork was. You know, he waddled like a duck. He slapped punches. He couldn't do anything. And he became 1994 Commonwealth Games gold medalist, went to the Olympic Games. And him achieving that was greater than Otis winning a world title, because Otis was really good. You know, he had to win a world title. He was good. Ron was not. Ron shouldn't have been that good, and he was. And that proved to me that I could be a coach and made me the belief that I could turn somebody into a fighter.
I think it's, you know, I've known you for a number of years, and I think it's a testament more to be a great teacher. There are guys that have been fighters that doesn't mean they can be a coach. They might have all the knowledge in
100%.
The world, but they have to be able to communicate it.
Correct.
And that's what's difficult, and that's one of the things that you're so good at. You're a people person, and I think, obviously, you're great at hand wrapping. You're a great cut man. And by the way, a good cut man is worth his weight in gold, in my opinion, but we can talk about that in a second. But the fact that you work with these top guys and then you continue to work with them shows that you work very well with others. You know, you're a great guy to be around.
Well, thanks, Dave. I appreciate that.
You have a big passion for the sport, and you have a passion for people, and you care, and it shows. And I think that's why people like to be around you.
And I'm bloody OCD. Like, that's why, you know, like, the hand wrap is, I got it so, because I wanted to find a way to make it perfect, you know, and I devised a way to make what I felt is the perfect hand wrap, and I take care when I do it. And it's easy to do a wrap, you know, you can, but to do it really good and to really put that fine detail on it, that's the same thing I do when I'm training a fighter. So I'm lucky in that way that I have that ability to do that. And I think that I fell into boxing because of Vinny Curto. Vinny gave me the belief that I could be a trainer. John Davenport nurtured that became my mentor and treated me with the respect that I was a trainer, not could become, that I was. But had I fallen into another sport, like I said, had it been baseball or hockey, I believe I'd have had the same type of success, because I understand how a game works. I understand the analytics of it. I understand why things happen the way they do. I see things that the layman doesn't see. And that's the same with magic. You know, you do things and you can make things happen that a layman doesn't see.
Sleight of hand.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, also hand wrapping, right? These are the tools of the trade.
Of course.
And there are so many bones, so many tiny, intricate, delicate bones.
36,
in there.
I think, is the and accurate count.
This is what guys work with.
Yeah.
And you're pounding on them. People don't realize that, you know, the guys are wearing gloves and they're taped their gloves not to to make it soft on the face. It's to protect your hand.
Yeah, of course it is.
You know, and that's why when I hear people say like, oh, bare knuckle boxing is so brutal. Yeah, sure, it's brutal. But I think real boxing is the most brutal because these have become weapons.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when it's taped up correctly, you know, because you want to protect the hand, but there needs to be circulation. It can't be too tight.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to it. How did you come up with your...
A lot of trial and error, you know, figuring I could make it better. Okay, this wasn't good enough. No, I'm not happy with this. And just trial and error going back and forth of how to do things. And to this day, I still use a technique where a lot of fighters, a lot of trainers today, when they wrap hands, they use a pad. They make a pre-made pad where they take gauze and roll it up and then they place it on the hand and then they fold it over and they make a pad. And I learned from Roger Larrivee, one of the first guys to, you know, ever show me how to do this. And he used a method where he built the pad right off of the roll. And I still do that. And one day I'm in Cincinnati and I'm taping up a fighter's hands and I'm doing that. And this old man, he's got a cane and he's walking by and he stops. Old black guy stops. He said, "Man, you old school," he says, and then walked out of the room. And I said, he recognized that. So from that era, he remembered how that was done. And that's how I learned. And I'm the only guy I've ever seen myself do that, you know, of the new generation of guys in the game. So it's just trial and error. And I figured I got it right and got the feel and pulled the tape just right and do it. And for each guy, you also have to ask them if they have any issues that have to be protected, you know, but I've been lucky to do that. And the reputation, that's another thing, that it's not something that I brag about or that I post or that I try to sell, you know, in social media that I do this, hire me, you know, I don't do that. It's my
reputation. All word of mouth.
Yeah, it's become a word of mouth, which is the way rival boxing became, you know, was by word of mouth. You put out a good product and eventually people will say it's good, and if it's bad, they're going to say it's bad.
Let's talk about Rival just for a second. I love the slogan that you guys have, you know, we're boxing people trying to get into the business world. We're not business people trying to get into the boxing world.
Yeah.
And I love that because you do come from a boxing background. Correct. And a knowledgeable boxing background.
Rival would be more successful if I was a businessman. You know, it would be more successful.
Right, right.
Yeah.
What's the logo? I've always wondered that. What's that? What's the logo?
Well, if I could show you, basically, if you turned it upside down,
is it just the outline, the tribal of the gloves?
No, it's this is the tip of the maple leaf, right? That's the maple leaf upside down.
Okay.
That's the maple leaf upside down, and the R on each side when you put them together, one R is for Russ, and the other one is for Rival. So that's how it kind of came. It's Canadian, and that's kind of how we did it. So
I've always wanted to know what that was.
Yeah, it was just a little
I've seen Rival gloves. A lot of guys wear them. In fact, okay, so hold on. There's a funny thing that happened with us.
Okay.
But it was also a great night for you and your company.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Gassiev and
first
Usyk.
First time you pushed me and wanted to pick a fight. And,
I did. It's true. Yeah. It's true.
I was going to say, you got to tell that story.
I felt terrible, man. We were in Russia. We were in Moscow. Yep. And undisputed cruiserweight championship of the world.
It was the Ali Trophy.
It was Oleksandr Usyk and Murat Gassiev. What a night that was. I mean, what an event. The fight actually turned out to be not so great. It kind of fizzled. You know, Oleksandr was just
dominant.
He was dominant.
But I mean, that was great. Like to be that dominant when you weren't everyone. Lots of people picking Gassiev to win.
Yeah, Gassiev was punching holes through walls.
Yeah.
I mean, very strong fighter. He had a great fight with Dordikos, which is amazing down in Sochi. Man, that was a great fight.
Yeah,
super exciting. That was a great tournament. That was a great year.
It was.
But they both used Rival gloves.
Yes, they did.
So that must have been really exciting for you.
Yeah. Well, the thing that's for me, the thing that I'm happiest about, Dave, with all the guys who wear Rival, is they wear it because they want to. We're not paying anybody. I don't have the budget to make endorsement deals with guys. I have no contracts with any of the fighters. They wear it because they want to wear it. And them wearing it, Gassiev and Usyk wearing it, was the highlight for my company. And the second one was Usyk against Anthony Joshua, where they both wore Rivals as well, you know? So, again, like I said, you know, Usyk, well, maybe not Usyk, but Joshua could probably buy my company with his pocket change, you know? Like, he could take it. He could choose any glove he wants. And the fact that he asks us to make them and has been using them since he won the title against Charles Martin, I think that's the thing I'm happiest about the most. And the same with me as a cup man, the guys I work with, you know, there's lots of guys they could choose from. You know, the fact that they find a guy in Montreal, that it's because they like me and they want me there. So I don't try to push myself onto people. I don't try to say, hey, please, can I be your cup man today? You know, I don't do that. If they want me, you know, all they have to do is ask. And I'm glad that I'm in a position in my life now where I can be selective as to who I work with, because I want my beliefs and my character to be reflected in the fighter that I work with, you know. And I like the way Conlan conducts himself. I like the way Usyk and Loma conduct themselves, you know, their class. And that's the image that I love for boxing, and that's what I want to see, and that's what I want to be associated with.
Speaking of Usyk and Loma, have you spoken to them recently?
I didn't speak to Loma. I spoke to his father, and I spoke to Usyk, you know, almost every couple of days I send a message. And you know, it's obviously just, you know, questions of, you know, be careful and are you okay? And yes, we're okay now, you know. And but it's obviously not okay in the sense they're okay that they're not dead and they're not injured.
No, it's not okay.
Yeah, it's not okay how they are. So there's nothing okay about this. There's nothing okay about, you know, one day you go to bed with a color TV, a car, your apartment, all your clothes, everything you have. The next day you have none of that. You're packing a suitcase and fleeing a city, and your building's being bombed. One of the guys that I taught as to be a cut man, name is Sergey, the building behind his home was detonated by a bomb, you know, and they had to leave. So, you know, you just leave everything there, and you it's not like you can go to the bank machine and take out a withdrawal, you know, and there's cash there, you know, like, you have no access to that. So you go from living a regular, normal life like we're living now, and tomorrow you have nothing. And that shouldn't be happening in the year 2022, you know, that tanks can roll in and rockets can be fired upon your city. That shouldn't be happening, you know. It's not right.
It really makes the sport of boxing seem small and insignificant.
Of course.
Compared to what they're going through.
Of course.
Tough stuff.
And it's not right. Like, and as it's... The humanity of it is just despicable. Like, are we really still going through these kind of things in this day and age in modern Europe? You know, it's not a third world nation. It's not a place that's underdeveloped. We're talking about, you know, 21st century Europe, and tanks are rolling into your city and invading another country. And it's sickening, really, when you think about it. I mean, we sit here all nice and comfortable and talking boxing and reflecting, but these people are fighting for their lives, and it's just awful, man. I can't believe that it's even happening, and it's like the whole world's not doing anything about it. Like, how are you okay with sitting around and letting this happen? And it just goes to show that, you know, the allies sometimes you think you have maybe are not your allies anymore. And I don't see how this thing finishes well. You know, how the Russian people themselves are not going to suffer in the future also, you know, because they're now going to be, they're the most hated place on earth right now. We were on the verge of opening rival Russia. I was within a couple of weeks of announcing it. We've had trademarks done, the whole bit. We were going into
Russia. You guys have, well, obviously you started in Montreal.
Yeah.
But you have Las Vegas.
Yeah.
You have UK.
Yeah.
And you have Australia, right?
Yeah. And we were going to have, and France. And France is going to be opening soon. And, we were going into Russia. I had made a friend over there that I had met 5-6 years ago. We became friends. We've stayed in touch. He's come to all the fights. Every time I go to Russia, he takes care of me. We developed a real bond together, and he wanted to do that. And I finally found somebody I could trust to do that, who wanted to do that and loved boxing. And we were on the verge, literally, of doing it. And now I'm probably too old now to ever see the realization of this. You know, we would have been the first brand to have opened in Russia. You know, a boxing brand to open an office in Russia, we'd have been the first one to do it. I mean, there's been other brands that had distributors, you know, like other guys selling all kinds of stuff, but this would have been exclusively Rival. And we were ready to announce that. We're proud to go do that. And now I can't do that. And now my friend is suffering as a result of that. You know, and it's not right. It's not right.
Speaking of going
didn't
back,
didn't mean to be somber about that.
No, it's a terrible situation going on right now, and I think we need to talk about it, especially that you work so close with these fighters, and I'm also close to those fighters,
yeah.
And we all care about them,
of course.
So it's you know, hoping for the best. But going back to friends that you talked about before, you were talking about Buddy McGirt a little bit before. I mean, you know, one of the great trainers, one of the great guys in boxing,
100%,
hell of a fighter. And a hell of a trainer.
Yeah.
He honestly is a hell of a trainer. But I'm wondering, you know, because you have worn so many hats in this boxing business, like we've talked about, and your role now, whether it's a hand wrapper or whether it's a cut man, it's not trainer, but yet you do know a lot and you were a trainer for a long time. So what is it like to be in a corner and you're seeing something, but you don't want to overstep your...
I overstep. If I see something, I overstep. That's it.
I remember hearing some story where you told Buddy something and he went straight to his fighter.
You were actually the ring announcer that night. It was in New York. Isaac Chalemba was fighting.
Okay.
I think it was on a DiBella show.
Okay.
And you were the ring announcer and we're sitting down there, and this was one of the first times I'm working with Buddy. And I told him something. He went upstairs. And then I realized, okay, he's listening to what I'm saying.
Right.
And the way I got it, what Buddy also did something else for me, which was really great because it opened up a door for me, was here in Manchester. I was here with Chalemba and Buddy. And Joe Gallagher asked Buddy if he would come and wrap Anthony Crawley's hands.
Okay.
And Buddy said, Joe, he says, you know, I do a good rap, he said, but I'm not even doing Chalemba. He says, this guy's doing him.
Yeah, he's not. Yeah.
He said, would he do? And I did. Crawler was the first UK fighter's hand that I ever wrapped.
$1 million.
And Crawler. I always tell Crawler, he's the first guy. And as a result of that, you know, I got to work with Callum Smith and Liam and all of Joe Gallagher's guys because of that. And Callum became the second Ali Trophy winner that I was in the corner. So I was in the corner for the first Ali Trophy win and for the second Ali Trophy win. Yeah. So
that was a great night. Special. And I was there too, obviously. I announced it. And that fight was the very first boxing match ever in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
That was a great, wasn't that a great experience?
It was a great experience.
I loved it.
And it was great. And for Callum, you know, you talk about those moments when, like, you know, Otis Grant, when he won his title, and these great moments that you had, when Callum Smith, you know, coming from that family of the four fighting Smith brothers, you know, proud city, Liverpool, you know, such a fighting history, when he won that title, and to be able to announce it and watch him, the glee, the joy, like this, oh man, it was wonderful.
Well, that was another example, and Crawler is my living proof of this. So if he's listening to this, he's the living proof of this. And this is no word of a lie. He's in the corner with us, me, Joe, and him, and the fight's going on, and Callum is having good success, but he can't get Groves in trouble, you know, like he's throwing the right hand, and Grove typically, you know, rolls with the right hand and comes back with his own right hand, and I'm watching this. He comes back to the corner, and before, you know, we get mouthpiece out, before he goes out for the next round, just to get his attention, I slapped him with an open hand right on his chest. I slapped, pop, pop, pop. I said, throw the fucking left hook. Throw the left hook. He went out there, threw the left hook, knocked out George Groves.
That's all she wrote.
And Crawler says, Russ, you called it, mate. You called it, mate. So he's my only proof of that. That was the call that I was calling for, that left hook. And Paul Smith was sat behind as well, and he heard that. So when you said overstep my mark, sometimes I can.
So you do.
As a coach.
You're okay with that. You're not worried about it.
No.
So, and I think that the coach Saturday night, if you see something, you're going to tell Adam Booth.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. 100%.
Now, do you ever say it yourself when you're in the corner, or you say it to the trainer and let them?
I'll say it to the trainer. You know, like, we'll be sat there. There'll be myself.
Sure.
Charlie Beats, Huzaifa will be there. Right. Or say, look, we got to do this. Or sometimes Adam might see the same thing. So now we're both yelling the same instruction. And it's, or like, be aggressive or not, or move or whatever. If we're both seeing the same thing, okay, great, no problem. I don't have to make, I'll just say what he's saying. But in the event that I see something that they're not calling, and I know that that's working, I'll yell it out, you know, and send the message. And, you know, Jamie, I felt very comfortable having Jamie there as well, because I talked to Jamie and his dad, like, they'll say, yeah, Russ is calling the right thing. He's calling the right thing. So I know that I feel their support on this makes you feel comfortable. So I know they don't bring me there just to shut up. I mean,
come on. Of course. I mean, smart people that will bring you in for the right reasons. Okay, fine, maybe to wrap the hands as a cut man, but they also want your expertise.
Of course.
And other things too.
It'd be silly not to have it, you know. It'd be silly
this
not
to
have
it. This is boxing.
Yeah, that's
true. There are a lot of egos.
Yeah, there is.
This is boxing.
Yeah.
You speaking of the Smiths just for a second, and let's just move on to Beefy for a second, because I know you like billiards. So he's one of the guys. So supposedly, I hear Roy Jones, he can shoot a game of pool.
Yeah,
he can. Abel.
Abel's good. Yeah.
And Beefy, supposedly really
Beefy's
nice.
Beefy's very good. Beefy might be the best of the
three. He's nice on the felt.
Yeah, yeah, he might be the best of the three because he plays snooker as well.
Okay,
so he might be the best of the three.
Anyone else that you've come across that's really
the only I don't know if you were with us. I'm not sure you were there when Manny Pacquiao fought in Macau.
No, I was not there.
So I was there with Jesse Vargas, and we were in the the basement of the hotel where they're having the weigh-ins and the press media and all that stuff, right, to stay away from the population. They had it downstairs, and Manny was there. And so Roy and Manny started talking, and I was there, and we started talking. And we talked for 20 minutes about pool, right, because he's an avid pool player. Sure. So we talked about playing pool. We didn't even talk about boxing. We just talked about who we knew in the pool industry, the Filipinos, that the famous Filipino pool players, and we talked about that. And he invited me and Roy to go to his tournament in the Philippines, but we haven't had a chance to do that yet, but that's something I'd like to do. But Manny's supposed to be the best. I haven't played him, but he's supposed to be. Yet. But out of the people that I played, Beefy, Roy, and Abel are good. The running joke I had with Abel was we were playing in Las Vegas, and I was on a run where I was winning, and Abel was racking the balls. And I said, Abel, you better be careful not to commit a crime in this town. And he said, why not? I said, because your fingerprints are all over that rack. he's fun. He's fun. Abel's fun to play.
He's a great guy. Abel, yeah. Very great boxing
mind. But you got to tell the story about how we met, what our initial meeting was, despite seeing you at various events, because obviously you're the ring announcer.
You're talking about me pushing you in the ring?
Yeah, yeah. Tell them how you wanted to start a fight. I think that's... tell them. Let's see
you
if
tell the story, please.
Let's see if your recollection is the same as mine. So it was the fight.
Well, they were in my ear. They were telling me to get to the center of the ring.
Right.
You happen to be in the way.
In the center of the ring. And this guy pushes me out the way, man. He pushes me out the way. Yo, who you think you're pushing, man? Ring announcer guy. And then we became friends after that.
Afterwards. I felt terrible, man, because at the time I was looking at my producer Q, whatever, and so I was not really too worried about you.
I see that.
And then I realized you were the guy that
okay.
Oh, man.
But you know that it's funny how those things happen, because I'll tell you a story. When Lomachenko sparred Shakur Stevenson prior to the Guillermo Rigondeaux fight.
Sure.
They were in the gym.
By the way, prayers going out to Guillermo Rigondeaux.
Oh, yeah, that was terrible. Yeah.
I hope he's doing okay. Yeah. I can't believe this.
Crazy.
Terrible story.
Yeah.
But I hope he makes a full recovery.
Yeah, they're saying that that could come back, right? But they don't
know yet.
They're
saying, yeah. Okay, I think it's a little early. I hope so, too.
I followed him when I was doing Olympic Games. I covered all his fights as an amateur.
One of the best Olympians ever.
Absolutely.
I mean, not to take anything away from Loma, I mean, Rigondeaux moved up two weight divisions.
Of course.
So that just has to be said. I mean.
So Shakur's in for sparring, and things get a little heated, and Shakur's hitting Loma low. Now was time for me to step over and say, hey, whoa, right. What's going on here? Hey, relax with the low blows, and I get mad, right? Well, Coach K Caroma, he starts, swearing and calling me names and whatnot, and then walks to the back of the room. Well, I followed him. I said, you got to say something to me? Come tell me what you want to say, and we start beefing it out, and everything. And now me and him are really good friends. When I see him, hug him up, and everything is good. But it started in a very confrontational way, as with you. But it's very nice.
Very nice. Yeah. I tell you, I'm so...
I protect my fighters, David.
You have to. Yeah. I'm very honored that you're on the podcast today. And you're one of the faces I love seeing during fight week. And again, you work with the top in the game, and that's for a reason.
Well, thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. And I'm really honored that you asked me to be on here. It's very nice. Nice to go down memory lane with you as well.
It's been fun.
Listen, for whatever you've said about my career in boxing, I remember when you started out, because you have your trademark as well, and you're a hard guy to miss. And, you've really evolved into doing something for yourself as well, from a position where in the past nobody ever thought that that's a position that evolves to something, and you made it evolve into something. So congratulations to you as well. And you did it outside of America as well, not only in America. So you're a real success story.
Thank you, my friend. So before we leave, because my producer Jamie over here he's so upset.
We over the time? I'm sure.
Oh yeah, and he's been waving at me, and I've been acting like I'm not seeing him, but
I'm not seeing him.
Like, okay, I've got great peripheral.
Okay,
so I've seen every wave that he's done, and I see him getting redder by the
Sorry,
minute,
brother.
But would you answer a couple fan questions?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, great.
Why not?
So we have some fan
questions. I hope I can answer them.
Okay, great. All right, let's see. Reno Sanchez asks Russ, how did you get into the glove game? How much time went into crafting the rival glove as it is today?
I got into the glove game almost by into the equipment business. No, I shouldn't say that. The rival came up by accident. I've been selling equipment since 1985. I started Ringside Equipment in Canada. I was the guy that was selling. Ringside had just started up in the U.S. I started selling in Canada. I developed the brand in Canada. From there, I went to starting Title Boxing in Canada. They were my friends who also worked at Ringside before, and we started Title Boxing, and I started doing that. One day, I'm toying with the idea of wanting to do my own equipment because I realized, you know, both brands, Ringside and Title, you know, I developed in my country. So I kind of started to understand that people were buying equipment because it was from me. You know, they were trusting me that it was coming from me. So I said, I toyed with the idea. My brother came up with the name of Rival. And I get a visit from a supplier in Asia who comes to see me and says, you know, we'd like to make gloves for you. And I show him the Title gloves I'm selling. And okay. And he says, you know, it's the container is the minimum order. And I said to him, listen, this is what I want to do. I want to do this, that. I show him the pictures, the plans, what we want to do. I said, but I don't have the financing to do a container. He says, okay, when you do, let me know. Shukranzi left. Next day, he comes back. I get a call from reception. They say, Mr. Tariq is downstairs. He wants to see you. So, okay, he comes back up. He says, oh, Mr. Russ, he says, I don't sleep last night. I said, why? He says, because I think Rival is going to be very good. He says, whatever you have, no minimum, whatever you need, I'll do it for you. I said, I've only got $2,000, Mr. Tariq. That's all I got right now. I said, but this is what I'd like to make. He says, I make that for you. I said, if you do that for me, I guarantee you every order after that will be more than $2,000.
And it has
even
been.
If it's only by a dollar, it'll be more.
And it has been.
And that's how the company started. So, and then the fight gloves took a while to develop. You know, you make a fight glove and you get one fighter who says they like it and the other guy hates it. So listen, now you're trying to find the happy medium between the two and to get it consistent. Like it's one thing to develop the prototype for it, but then to put that into production and keep getting that same fit and feel that
correct.
You loved in the prototype, that's not easy. So that took a while, but we're in a good place now, and we've got a good glove. And like I said, the people who wear them because they want to, not for any other reason.
Would you say it's more like, you know, Reyes is known as a puncher's glove?
See, that's a myth. You know,
it is the myth, right? Yeah. And some people wear Grant, some people wear, there's so many different types of gloves, you know, Everlast and Leone, all kinds of wonderful gloves out there. What do you look at Rival? Where do you feel that you're as a glove?
I'm never going to say we're better than anybody.
No, but what would you say the strength of the glove is? Is it comfort?
Well, the fit, I think, is you know, the fit is when you get in. Like, we built it in a way, because I wrap hands, I designed it in a way that it'll accommodate the hand wrap that I wrap.
Right.
So, and if you wrap your hands like I do, which is good, you know, a good wrap, you're going to get into our glove without being constricted in any way. The thing that about the puncher's glove, every time somebody says that to me, I say, please, you have to understand. You're the puncher, not the glove, okay? If you're a puncher, don't blame the glove. Right. Because at the end of the day, putting a glove on a fighter is the equivalent of putting your bed pillow on the bumper of your car and hitting somebody at 100 miles an hour.
Yeah,
it's irrelevant. You know, you might not get as much blood on the bumper, but that's about it.
Sure.
So when you can punch in any of the gloves that any of the top brands make, whether 100%. It's mine, Grant, 100%. Winning, if you can punch, you're knocking somebody out.
To correlate, like I was a drummer, right? I used to play drums, and I've seen these guys with the this and the double bass and the, how many tom-toms, and then you see a guy with just like a hi-hat or a paint bucket, and he's just, you know, just killing it. If you could play, you could play. If you could punch, you could punch.
Exactly. There's no, you're talking about an 8 and 10 ounce glove.
Right.
So there's not much there to begin with in any brand you're looking at. There's not much there.
There's not much.
That's not the difference between getting knocked out. And whoever believes that, you know, now you're looking for a reason that lays somewhere else instead of looking at yourself. Because I'll tell you what, Arthur Beterbiev, wearing 16 ounce gloves, he's crushing guys, you know, 18 ounce gloves. He's crushing guys in the gym because he can punch. Doesn't matter the size of gloves he's wearing.
Got that fight coming up with Joe Smith Jr., huh?
Indeed.
Man.
Yeah, another great Woo! One. Yeah.
Love
looking
that
forward
fight.
To that. Yeah.
Love
yeah.
both guys.
Yeah.
I've known Joe a long time.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
I used to announce his fights in the amateurs.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
Great guy.
Yeah.
Great guy. And his trainers and
yeah, Jerry. Good, yeah.
Yeah, Jerry and his brother.
Bianco, yeah.
Yeah, the great guys.
Absolutely.
And Artur, I mean, I got to spend time with him up there in Canada.
Oh, okay.
When he was up to Kell Brook, used to train up there.
Kell Brook.
Yeah, Kell Brook was up there. Artur Beterbiev. I think it was in Toronto.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's in Toronto.
Okay.
I did some shows for Lee Baxter.
Oh, right, okay.
And those guys were down there.
Yeah.
And we all got to hang out, and we had a lot of fun. And then...
Arthur's great guy. He's hilarious.
He really is.
Oh, my God, he's hilarious.
It was a really tough fight against Callum Johnson. I don't know if you remember that fight.
Sure, I do.
That was...
Sure, I remember that.
That
I was there.
Close.
I was there.
That was very close.
I was there. And that was, unfortunately... Normally, I work with Callum Johnson as his cut man and hand wrapper. But, you know, like...
Yeah, how does that go when you...
Well, look, I mean, I've been with Arthur since... You know, since his pro debut, like I've been in his corner for every fight except the last one because I got COVID. But, you know, that, there are certain guys that, you know, I have to stay loyal to because I've been with them for that length of time, you know, and I don't want someone to use me just to say, oh, we're going to use him again, because I won't do it. I just
no,
work
of course
the corner.
Not.
I
of
hate
course.
That stuff. So
of course.
I won't do that. But in this case, Callum, I work just every now and then. If I happen to be in the UK, if Joe had me, I would. But
well, I was going
to
say, because Callum was at Joe's gym.
That's right.
He was with Joe Gallagher.
Correct. And I worked his corner when he fought Carpensi, mm-hmm. I believe, mm-hmm. You know, in New York. Okay, I was there. He used me, no problem. But it wasn't like an everyday thing. So when the fight
sure.
got announced against Callum Johnson, what could I do?
Yeah, you know, you're with Arthur.
I'm with Arthur. He's you my know, guy.
He told Arthur, when I announced him, he told me, because I'm very specific about asking about names and pronunciations, and he told me Beterbiev. So that's what I say.
Yeah,
but most everyone says Beterbiev.
Yeah. My friend says Better Believe.
Yeah, better believe.
Yeah, but I guess the North American pronunciation, if we read it as we would, you know, phonetically, it's Beterbiev, you know, works.
Sure.
Beterbiev.
That's what he told me. So
it's a question of where the accent is on, right?
Sure.
So
speaking of, you obviously you speak English. You speak French.
Speak
French.
English, French.
And you do speak Spanish too, yeah?
Un poquito, yeah.
Un poquito.
When it comes to boxing, I'm very comfortable to speak in Spanish.
Sure. Sure.
And ordering food. I'm good with ordering food. That's
there you go.
That's important.
Okay. Before my producer has a heart attack over here. Okay. Next question. Peter_Davies16 asks Russ, do you agree with the general consensus that it's a Wood KO or Conlan points this weekend?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I think in both cases. I think Ben Davidson was right. He says we could win on points or we could win by knockout. Yep, they're very good. You're right. We could.
Sure.
Both of them could. So I don't think it's a consensus that I don't think Woods can only win by knockout,
right,
and
right.
I don't think that Conlan can only win by points. You know,
sure.
I think it's a very very more evenly matched fight than people think.
I do too. That's why I'm made up for this fight.
I think people might be underestimating McConlan.
Final question. David Cartwright asks Russ, can you tell us any stories when you've been hand wrapping and you've had to start again from a protest from the opposition?
Never happened. Never happened. And I will. Buddy McGirt, who I trust, but, you know, we weren't always close. As I worked against him when with Sergio Martinez. And he came into the dressing room, watched me wrap for 2 minutes. And said, I'm out of here.
Yeah,
because he knows that I'm not going to cheat, you know,
sure.
And I won't, because that's the part of boxing that I hate the most. You know, I hate what happened to Billy Collins. I hate what Panama Lewis did to Luis Resto. You know, like I hate that shit.
Assault
I hate
in the ring.
Cheating.
If you haven't seen that movie,
yeah.
Everyone, Assault in the Ring.
So when I'm with inspectors or the other camp. Sometimes I feel the other camp comes in just as, oh, this is a free opportunity to watch Russ Amber wrap hand. It's like a free hand wrapping lesson.
Right,
that's
right,
the sense I get when they're watching me.
Sure.
I know they're not watching me because they think I'm cheating.
Right.
And because I have a good reputation. They're not watching. They're getting a free hand wrap lesson is what they're getting, you know, and that pisses me off. You know, they get to watch that. And the inspectors, I say, whether you're here or not, I'm wrapping the same way.
100%.
I wrap the same way in the gym. I wrap the same way. I'm not going to cheat. I won't do that. And I believe strongly in that. I mean, I know we have to watch, you know, okay. But I don't play that. I don't play that. And so I've never had somebody have to ask me. They've tried to raise issues. Like we had a case where a guy says, hey, you're using more gauze than you're allowed to. You're only allowed to use two rolls. I said, yeah, but off of the roll, I already built a pad. Other people already have their pad ready. You're watching. That's because they don't understand. They don't get it, right? So I said, yeah, you didn't mind when the guy put a pad on your hand, which took a roll for him to make that pad, and then he used two more after. You don't think about that. I built it right off the roll. You saw me do it, you know? The other incident I had was in when Callum fought Canelo. It was with the Texas Commission, and we had three inspectors watching me rap. And like I said to you, I'm building the rap right off of the roll, right? So they're seeing it come off the roll.
Sure.
So I do finish it up. And then the guy grabs Callum's hand and he starts moving the stuff and pressing. Hey, I said, what are you doing? Yeah. Well, we have to check it. I said, bro, you had six eyes watching. What are you checking now after it's already done? You watched it go on. Right. I got really irate with that. And they were threatening to throw me out the corridor. And
did you have to rewrap or
no?
It was okay. It was okay.
It was okay. Of course it was okay. Sure. Like I said, I don't cheat. Yeah. So.
No, but I mean, did he mess it up?
No, he didn't. No, he didn't mess it up. But just the fact that he's doing this and I'm like he's saying he's doing his job. Bro, you watched me do it, man. Right. What are you pressing on? What exactly do you think you're going to... You think you're going to find... By pressing, you're going to find something that you didn't see me put in there? Like I put a roll of quarters or something in there? You're going to see... Stop, man. You know, that's the other thing, you know, commissions and whatnot. You know, they're so worried about how much Vaseline you're using. Oh, you put too much Vaseline. Yo, bro, guys are beating the shit out of each other with baseball bats in there. And you're worried about Vaseline? Really? You know, so they just want to impose sometimes, you know, and that. But me and Abel talk about that all the time about how they just want to feel like they're important to tell you what you must do. I've been in this game 43 years. You weren't even born when I was wrapping hands, so please, you're not going to tell me how to do that. So.
And different commissions in different places have different rules and different people that know what they do. I mean,
correct.
You go to a place like, you know, we're here in the UK, obviously the British Boxing Board of Control, you're in Las Vegas, you're in New York, you know, there are places, you know, California, there's some, you know, top commissions out there.
Yeah, and I have good relations with a lot of them, you know, and usually it's more the inspector who's trying to make his mark in the dressing room, you know, trying to, but, you know, it doesn't happen all the time, but it happens sometimes, and it happened then, so.
Listen, we have a great fight this weekend. Can't wait. I think the Motor Point Arena here in Nottingham is going to be buzzing. Going to go get some good food. We'll be back next week with Warrington and Martinez, too. Should be a great fight up in Leeds. And that's it. Russ, thanks a lot, buddy.
Glad to have you back, brother.
Thank you, my friend.
Have you back, man.
Talk soon.
All right, buddy.
All right,
thank
cheers.
You. Thanks, guys.